This episode is brought to you by Carbonite, the leader in online backup. Backup your PC or Mac off-site, securely and automatically. For a free trial offer plus 2 free months with purchase, go to Carbonite.com. Offer code TWIM. This week on the show, pay what you want for movies, watch them with iPad extras, upload your own, or just pirate them. Right here on This Week in Media, number 202. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to This Week in Media. This is Alex Lindsay sitting in for Daisy. Daisy is she's traveling the world. She's out there somewhere. So I will be holding down the fort with me. My usual partner in crime, Tim Street. Hey, Tim.
Hey, how's it going, Alex?
Good. And are you in L.A.?
I am in L.A. Kind of feels like Seattle today. A little overcast.
Wow, that doesn't happen very often.
No.
Get out and enjoy the lack of sun.
There you go.
Also here we've got Brett Rounseville from AM Trucker. Hey, Brett.
Yeah, hey, gang.
And now you have a new business you're starting up, right?
Oh, yes. Bounce.com. In fact, my mom just had to close her upholstery business of 27 years, and so this is what grew out of that.
Out of upholstery, what is the service that you provide?
We're mostly selling iPad cases right now. We're going into iPhone and iPod territory soon. Basically, we just had like thousands upon thousands of fabrics that built up over the course of 27 years and didn't have the heart to throw them away.
Oh my gosh. They look great.
Thanks.
They look very comfy.
They're pretty classy, and there's a lot of different designs out there already. Pretty cool. I'm proud of them for sure.
Yeah. No, I got some fabric from India. That I know that I made into a, I cobbled together something for my MacBook, and everybody wanted one. So getting something that's a little bit different than everybody else's is great. So that's Rounza.com?
Yeah, Rounsa.
Perfect. Also here is a regular contributor, Lon Seidman. Hey, Lon.
Hey there. How you doing, Alex?
Good. How is local TV treating you?
It's treating us well. We're cranking out a lot of content this month. Have some good potential revenue opportunities in the future here too. So we're working hard.
Fantastic. And we've got a lot of great news coming up here. Before we get started, I just want to thank our sponsor, Carbonite. Of course, Carbonite backs up your files automatically. Wherever you connect to the internet, your photos, your music, your emails, your financial records, office documents, all that stuff that you need to have backed up. Now, one of the big things that I think most people who have listened to the show will hear me talk about is really for me, it's three places. It has to be on the drive that I'm working on. I then back it up usually to something else internal, usually either a RAID 5 or a Drobo, and then it has to be on the cloud. So those are the three places that something has to be for me to consider it existing. It used to be two. We used to say if it's not in two places, it doesn't exist, and now we're really kind of moved to three because really having something in the cloud is super important. To make sure that you're just never going to lose it. So if you've got those records, and we just had somebody who hadn't backed up to something like Carbonite, and they lost about a week of work, and that's that would have paid for a lot of Carbonite. So anyway, it's definitely worth checking out. It's of course easy to use. You don't need any extra hardware or cables. You can use it to recover files, restore from previous versions of those files, transfer files from one computer to another. You can access your backup files from Carbonite.com website or their iPhone app, which is cool. Of course, it's secure. It's off-site, which means that theft, fire, floods. Even if you have got a great drive system, you still can't protect against those kinds of things. And you can even manage your own encryption key if you want. That's optional, and it's of course affordable. Unlimited backup for your PC or Mac is less than $5 a month or $55 a year, one flat fee. So definitely check that out. And you can go to Carbonite.com and enter the offer code TWIM. That's TWIM. And if you decide, you'll get it. You can try it for free. That way, you get 2 months for free. You don't need a credit card. You can do anything else. So just once again, go to Carbonite.com and use the offer code TWIM for 2 free months and see if it works for you. So anyway, check it out, Carbonite.com. All right. Off to the news. Story number one, Google Music might, you know, be coming out soon. It looks like they're going to be, you know, of course, they're going to, you know, this has been kind of, we were expecting some kind of Google Music. We're expecting some kind of Google TV. Tim, what does all of this mean?
It means good things for consumers so far, anyway, right, until we get hit with those extra bandwidth charges for using all this stuff. But it's kind of exciting. I mean, you know, back in, what is it, December of 2009, when Apple bought Lala, we thought they'd be launching a streaming music for service first. And there's a race. A race is on. So it's good for everyone, I think.
So, and this is, you know, taking the idea possibly for $25 a year, and of course we don't know exactly what's going to happen here, that you'll get a locker that you can store songs you've purchased or ripped from CD or downloaded illegally. This is of course, according to NPR Music. So there's a lot of possibilities with this locker that you can upload stuff and then stream from it. You can also stream possibly full-length songs. Now, Lon, do you think this is going to be able to compete against iTunes?
Well, I think so. Clearly, the locker thing is really attractive. I think I would actually use it as a backup. $25 a year to store probably my 40 or 50 gigs of music is a pretty good deal. The only thing I could see people getting a little irritated about, especially folks who have a large music collection that perhaps they acquired on iTunes during the DRM days, is that those songs probably won't play, right? If they're loading up the old protected songs. So they might have some hurdles to kind of get over when they first get going. But for Android users, this is great. I mean, Android really has lacked a really cohesive music application and back-end store that the iPhone has now and the iPod Touch does as well. So this is kind of a good thing for Google to do. They really have to do it to really stay competitive and try to offer a real alternative to what Apple is putting out.
Brett, do you think that the music industry is going to put up with this locker idea, this idea that people are going to be able to stream stuff? They say that Google's in negotiations, but do you think this is really going to move forward? Do you think that they are forward-thinking enough to go down this path?
That's my biggest hope about this story, is that finally the movie industry is moving in the right direction. I mean, I would love to see these people pull their heads out of other people's posteriors for once and really get something rolling. And we have a couple of other stories about old media doing some new media-ish things this week. So, man, I have high hopes for this, really.
Yeah, it's interesting times, possibly in the Chinese curse sort of way. So speaking of going the right direction, Freakonomics, they have a pay what you want screening. So of course, last month we were talking about Freakonomics movie was going to play with this, and it's going to be released online before it was in the theaters. But here is the proposal that they're talking about now, is they're going to have a special pay what you want screening in select cities, and this is going to be in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Washington D.C., Chicago, Boston, Dallas, Philadelphia, Denver, and Seattle. Now, you can't go for free. You have to pay something. So you have to choose a penny to $100. Now, if you want to pay more than $100, you have to bring two people. I think that's kind of the rule. So, and if you want to do less than a penny, well, you're going to have to find, you know, change from another country. So, so those are the possibilities there. And you're going to answer some survey questions. And it's really interesting because, they're going to figure out, this is part of their research. You know, that's what these guys figure out is the economics, the unthought of economics of what this looks like. So, Tim, do you think they're going to make more or less than they normally would with this kind of model?
Well, last night while we were sitting around the campfire singing Kumbaya, we thought this was great. But once we woke up this morning...
And the smoke cleared, right?
And the smoke cleared. I don't know. You know, in theory, wouldn't it be great if 1,000 fans would support you? But... I mean, you have to make a good product, and you have to sell that product at a reasonable price. Is this a reasonable price? Who's going to come? You know, is it going to turn movie theaters into smell-o-vision? Are you going to have a lot of stinky bums walking in, you know, for a penny? I mean, hey, you know, Santa Monica seems to be home of the homeless, so if they do the screening on 3rd Street Promenade, I'm sure that it'll be a great benefit to the local community.
Well, I know that for me, and I know this sounds really bad, but I would prefer the theater prices sometimes to be a little bit more expensive, mostly because it would get people who are more serious watching the theater. Like, I'd be much more, you know, I like going to it when it's more expensive because it just means that there's less people.
In Pasadena and some other parts of town, there's a place called Gold Class Cinemas.
Right.
And they're pretty expensive. I mean, tickets are like, I don't know, $25, something like that. And it's more of a nightclub experience where there's a cocktail lounge. You can wait till the movie starts. You can order really nice food, really good food and drinks. And they will bring those drinks to your reclining chairs.
Nice.
And so it's a great movie-going experience. You pay more for it. I think there's only 12 seats in the theater.
12 seats?
Wow. Yeah.
And they're only charging $25? I guess they must be making a lot on alcohol.
Yeah. It's crazy. It's like there's nobody there. It's like, you know, a home screening theater that's awesome.
Yeah. That sounds awesome. Now here's the question I have for you, Lon. The issue sometimes isn't so much that it's too expensive or too little, but that it's too complicated. So if someone has to, if we had to decide how much we were going to pay for everything, and everything was kind of a moving target, that might be something that I think that one of the challenges that Americans aren't really used to. I know that as when I go to other countries, when I'm buying stuff on the street or you're walking around, everything's a negotiation. You know, it is really right. Like, what are you willing to pay? Because I'll sit there and say, well, I'm willing to pay $3, and they want $8, and then we haggle back and forth, and we end up at $4.50 or $5, and that's kind of this constant thing that you do overseas. And I know the first time I went, I wasn't comfortable with it. Do you think people are going to be comfortable with this idea? Do you think it could go any further than an experiment?
I think it's just an experiment, mainly because the theater operators are going to freak out if people can come in and pay a nickel like my father used to do in Brooklyn to go see a double feature or something. You know, it doesn't work.
But don't they make all their money on popcorn?
The theater that I'm nearby does, that's for sure, because they get you for $25 for popcorn, right. And they don't even clean the floors after I go in there. So,
right.
I think there is something to be said though about people having some value to the content they're consuming and paying something that they feel it's commensurate with what they're getting out of it. And Leo's tip jar is a great example. You know, Leo Laporte has his tip jar, which has been very successful. John C. Dvorak's No Agenda show is also completely run by people donating money to the show because they find it a valuable resource. So I could see this being something that goes parallel with other revenue streams. We've done on a smaller site we were operating had kind of a tip jar subscription model, and people that weren't even living in the community that we were operating in were giving us money for it, which was, hey, I'm not going to turn it down.
Right.
It was valuable to them. And I think that might be, another rung in the revenue stream for the future.
Brett, how much would you pay to watch?
How much would I pay? Well, I think that's the problem with this idea in general, is that people go see movies because they think $7 to $10 is what they should be paying to go see a movie. So I can't help feeling that a little bit leery of these situations all the time, because I see
I really want
to pay what you want as part of their PR. I feel like that's going to skew any kind of results they get because they're the only ones doing it right now. If every movie were like that, then
I really want to pay on my way out. I mean, I don't want to pay on my way in. I don't want to guess. I want to give me a base. So I'll pay you $5. Yeah. Bucks. And if it's a great movie, I'll give you another $10 or $15.
Yeah. And if it's really bad, I walk out midway through.
If it's bad, I'm not going to give you any more money. And if the theater isn't working well, if the sound doesn't work well, you know, that kind of thing, I'm off the hook as well. I'm not going to give you any more money for that. So I think, to me, that would work. But you think this is just too complicated?
Well, it's not that I think it's too complicated.
It's not accurate.
I think it's such an isolated experience. I mean, yes, Freakonomics is doing it, and I feel like they're going to come out and tout all of these amazing results, but they're such one-of-a-kind results that I just don't – this just feels like a huge gimmick to me that really doesn't matter in life at all.
And it's been very effective because we're talking about it. So so that gimmick has worked well. Well done, guys. So on to story number three. Disney and Nielsen team up for an iPad app. Now, I've been trying to reduce the number of Apple-related stories that end up in This Week in Media, but this one I thought really was interesting. So Disney and Nielsen have joined forces, this is according to The Hollywood Reporter, to launch a free iPad app that could turn the device into a companion screen for the content and social media synchronized, and that's the key piece, to a TV program. So you can download this and multitask between TV experience and iPad. which will display polls, trivia, and other content timed to the relevant time to be relevant to the transpiring what's transpiring in the storylines. And so, Tim, do you think this is going to have a big impact? Is this the first step down a slippery and dangerous slope?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's a good thing. I think it's going to open up a lot of doors, both on the monetary side and on the creative side. I think this is going to be the gateway to interactive programming in ways we haven't thought of it yet. So yeah. I'm excited about this.
In a lot of ways, this is it's just been too hard to figure out a way to do this with a controller. You want to keep the controller simple, but you want to have complex opportunities to interact with the content. While I think that ABC is going to do this with these pieces, I think it will be more interesting with nonfictional content. I mean, imagine being able to be sitting there watching. To me, when I saw this, I was like, if I was sitting watching Good Eats while I had an iPad app that was popping up all the things that Alton Brown was talking about, it would be really expensive for me. You know, to be sitting there. I mean, that would be the most expensive show on TV for me, because who cares about buy what you, you know, pay what you want. I'd be like, oh, yeah. I mean, it'd be like $200 a show. So, you know, that's the danger. Now, Lon, do you think that this has an impact for news as far as people being able to interact with that news as they're watching it?
Yeah, absolutely. Because there's, especially for the news that we do, because we're doing 2-minute packages, and, it kind of fits within the average attention span that is out there for online video right now. But we often get people writing saying, hey, we want more. We want more detail. Can you show us more detail? So having links that – because we often put up our uncut footage of interviews that we do. So having that uncut thing feature itself onto the iPad thing. And I think ABC has attempted this before. If I'm not mistaken, way back when Who Wants to Be a Millionaire was on the air, wasn't there a synchronized game or something that they were doing at the same time on the computer? I can't remember specifically, but it was hard because you had to sit in front of your computer, and there wasn't wireless at that point. It was very inconvenient, but the iPad certainly is a lot easier to hang on to. And in fact, for many people, maybe a remote control in the near future too. So, it's cool. I can't wait to try it out.
I know that I find that I want my iPad or my iPhone to be the interface to everything, because I just don't want to. I don't want to keep every time I have to find my controller, which is, you know, I have two little kids, and my daughter just started walking, which makes her dangerous, and and so now, you know, I never know where my controllers are. You know, if you leave them anywhere within the kids' reach, they could be anywhere. And every time I look for them, I'm like, you know, my iPhone is in my pocket all the time. And these controllers, there's like 4 different controllers. I got my Roku, and I got my TV controller, and I got my, and I just want to control it all with my iPad or iPhone. And in the same way, I want to interact with them. I can almost imagine this being like a pop-up video type thing as well. I mean, where you get all those extra details that you want to be able to choose when you watch them and when you don't. Brett, do you see yourself being able to sit down and use a device like this?
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't be more excited about this. I already do this every single time I watch TV. It's rare that I don't have IMDb or Wikipedia open on my laptop or iPad when I'm watching TV.
Right.
I'm constantly answering questions that I'm asking myself the whole time I'm watching.
It is very...
I don't know if it was...
Go
ahead.
No, I was going to say this. I have the same thing. I feel odd if I'm sitting there in front of... Oh, I guess I feel like it's a waste of time if I'm just sitting there watching stupid shows. You know,
yeah,
like,
and what's really cool about this one, I don't know if it was clear to the listeners, but the whole reason Nielsen is involved is because they have this technology that they've been using for their tracking for years that they just found this brilliant new resource for. And literally, like, you don't even have to be watching live TV for this thing to sync to your iPad.
Right. Yeah. So this could really, I mean, and Nielsen, I mean, this has been the holy grail for the TV industry. When I was working at Prime Sports Network in 1993, 1994, you know, there was a company called Zing talking about interactive TV. I mean, this is not something that's new. It's just everyone can't quite figure out how to tie it together. And in some ways...
All that said, have you downloaded the app for this? Because it looks incredibly boring right now.
Yeah, no, I think it's a start. You know, I think it's just... everyone's still trying to figure it out. You know, I think these features, the feature sets will get a lot richer, you know, as this thing moves forward. But I definitely think that there's going to be a lot of growth in this area. In some ways, you know, at first I thought... Well, an extra screen, you know, you really need to do this. But I realized that in some ways I'd rather watch my videos on a TV or another computer and have a second screen that is really giving me all that extra information that I can choose to look at but don't have to, that I could work with while the show continues to play. You know, it's not taking up an extra, you know, window. It's going to be really interesting.
Yeah.
To see how
so like during all those really deep relationship scenes, you can see what other movies these people have been in.
Exactly. But and also, like, as I said, I think that the non-fictional stuff, so whether it's how-to videos, but also football. I mean, you know, I'm a big Steeler fan. So being able to watch the Steelers and have all the stats at my fingertips, which is what I have when I'm on my computer watching a Steeler game. But it'd be much nicer on an iPad. You know, to be able to do that. So, anyway, it'll be interesting. And you know, the Steelers have won 2 games so far. So, not that has anything to do with media. Just thought I'd let everybody know. Just without our quarterback. Story number 4 is our live video websites, the next internet fad. So this is according to Jessica Hartogs. Is that right? Did I say that right? From CNBC. It is last winter when the roof of a supermarket in northern Norway collapsed. Journalists were unable to get to the scene because of the freezing conditions, but they asked a local person in downtown Bambuser onto their mobile and go to the scene and film the damage. Now, the question is that, you know, there's a lot of this stuff happening. You know, people are starting to shoot stuff, and this is starting to become a growing industry. I mean, we're seeing iReport with CNN. We're seeing, you know, a lot more of this stuff. And I think that once we see, you know, interfaces for things like FaceTime, you know, I think that this may become a big deal. Tim, do you think that this is going to replace the traditional reporter?
I think it's going to add to the traditional reporter. I mean, sure, we may lose a few reporters here and there, but it's all about how this is aggregated and how easy it is to get a hold of this information. I had dinner the other night with a network that starts with a C and ends with an N and has one in the middle. And they're heavily...
Not to name anybody.
Yeah, they're heavily thinking about this more and more. I mean, you know, Steve Garfield, the first video blogger ever, who's been a guest on this show, you know, he's done iReports for CNN. And they're looking to take things to the next level. They're trying to figure out how to not just make it an internet fad, but really make it something that engages a community and gets people as a whole involved. And, you know, when you look at the whole 15 minutes of fame thing, I think there's a lot of opportunity there. How long people will be willing to do it for free, I don't know. And more interesting to me is, will somebody come out of the free postings and become a star? You know, will we see a Ashley Banfield rise up out of the iReporter crowd? That would be fun to see.
Well, and I think that the issue is, if YouTube and blogging is any indication, how long people will be willing to do it for free is probably forever. You know, I mean, as they grow in their capabilities, they might, you know, get paid, but it would be cheap. It would still be cheap for CNN compared to, you know, keeping staff, as much staff. I mean, you're never going to get rid of staff. You're going to have, you're always going to have professional reporters, professional commentators, so on and so forth. But I think that you're going to be able to find a very dense group of people who are newly empowered with their new toy, called their iPhone or their Android or just about any camera phone out there. And you know, I know that I'm tempted to, you know, I found myself, you know, there was a car on fire with all kinds of stuff going on around it, in San Francisco. And I found myself, you know, shooting some video. I didn't know what I was going to do with it. If I had had an iReport app that I could just shoot that into and then upload it, and it gave all the information, or I could type in a couple things and updo it, I think I'd be pretty likely to do that, even if I'm not going to get paid for it, just because I found it fascinating. Lon, do you think this is going
to
make...
Wait, just to be clear, there was a car on fire and you were standing there taking pictures of it?
Well, there was a fire truck around it. I mean, it wasn't... If the car was on fire, I'd be worried about, like, getting people out of it and doing all this stuff. The car was on fire, and there was 2 fire trucks, and they were trying to... what was kind of funny was the firemen were just standing around watching the car burn. You know, it was like, well, there's nothing to really be done about it now. Yeah, and so it was... they were just kind of watching it, making sure that it doesn't catch anything else on fire, make sure it doesn't blow up. You know, it was kind of one of those things. I don't know why they weren't spraying it down, but there was... And they may have just gotten there, and they were deciding how they were going to do it or what the danger points were going to be. I don't know what it was. All I know is I was driving down Franklin Avenue, and there's a car on fire. And I found myself, you know, taking pictures, trying not to, you know, I didn't want to spend too much time there. I didn't want to, you know, but I, you know, That's what, you know, anytime that news happens, and the thing is that now that all of us are empowered with those tools, you know, it is something that is just, you know, you kind of want to be part of the news in that way, especially if it's something that that's not very, I mean, I'm sure it was important to whoever's car caught on fire, but it's not generally important to the to the general population. But you can definitely see how when things are happening, how important that would be. And I think people would want to be part of history in that way. Lon, this must be a huge thing for what you're doing.
Oh, it's totally huge because it saves us a lot of time than anything. Because what happens is, you know, we're a small operation. So we have one man and one woman bands that go out and do these news packages. And what will happen is we'll hear from somebody who says, hey, I'm going to the American Idol audition. This actually happened. And, you know, do you want to do a story on me? And we said, yeah. In fact, here, take our flip camera. We have a whole bucket full of flip cameras that we pass out all the time. Take the flip camera and see what you first, because we knew it would probably get confiscated if you got too far into it. So, but he did a great package for us. He went out, talked, you know, kind of the night before thing, what he was doing to prepare, had this whole drive to the place talking about it. And what we do is we take the footage and wrap it around a professional news package. So CNN does this too. They'll do an on-air read or perhaps they'll work in the footage from the iReporter into something one of the CNN reporters are doing. And it's great. And it engages the community in such a way also that, you know, they can help us with the news gathering, but we're still providing the editorial filter, to keep me out of court because you never right. know what people might end up doing. But also because I do think that people would react better to a package thing of 2 or 3 minutes long versus a 10-minute foray of shaky footage from a flip cam. So we do some work on it. The Final Cut stabilizer is a godsend, and it's been great. And I'm you know, we want to do more of that. And the iPhone being out there is a big thing, as well as the Android phones too. They record great video, so it's especially for web purposes.
Brett, do you see yourself as becoming an iReporter getting involved in this, or are you going to hold out for a check?
Well, this is kind of what I used to do anyway. I'd wander around the country taking pictures of everything I saw and uploading it to the web before it was an option to go straight to CNN, and CNN still picked up on some of that stuff. So I really don't see this as a fad. I think it's just making things that much easier for everyone to get involved.
Right. Yeah. No, and it's funny when we when I wrote my first business plan for DV Garage, you know, one of the things we talked a lot about was video. You know, this is 2000, and we were saying, you know, 10 years from now, you know, you'll be, you know, when CNN's sending guys down to Zimbabwe to cover an election, you know, there'll be guys down there with their own cameras and they'll be shooting the stuff and they'll know the ground better than, you know, they'll know the context better than the CNN reporters.
Yeah, and in fact, when Bangkok had that whole thing a couple of months ago, I had a couple of friends who are travel bloggers that were in the area that were giving wildly different reports from what the major news sources were because they had been there for a couple of months. And I found that really valuable, if for no other reason than to get both sides of the action.
Right, and there was a lot of the pressure that happened that we saw with the elections in Afghanistan is that the traditional media was ready to just kind of rubber stamp the election as a success. And it was really the bloggers and some of the folks that were out there that were on the ground saying, you know, this isn't really working. You know, and that as that started to come out, it actually, you know, in some ways that led the news media to have to go down that path because there was too much leakage, you know, in the standard, quote unquote, standard story, you know, that was going out. And I think that's going to be a real challenge, I think, for governments as this really starts to pick up, not just traditional media, but there's a lot of, you know, spin control that oftentimes is being used. And while it's become more and more difficult, I think that as you end up with a world of people with cameras, I think it's very complicated to, you know, really execute the kind of, how do we say it, global stabilization projects that, quote unquote, that many governments engage in. It's very hard to do that because those pictures are going to end up on the internet, you know, in video.
It's just hard to hide now. Like instead of Big Brother, we have thousands upon thousands of tiny little brothers all over the place.
Yeah, absolutely. On to the next story. Speaking of lots of little brothers, Twitter overhauls twitter.com. Have you guys seen this interface? Have they changed yours?
I don't have it yet.
Heard about
Neither
it.
Neither do I.
So we'll talk about it a little bit, but we'll just kind of mention that you're going to see Twitter kind of moving over. It's going to be adding, they're going to reboot this. Not everyone has access to it yet, and none of us have access to it yet. Not that we're bitter But evidently, we're not important enough to update our Twitter. So, but it's got a split screen, you know, much like Twitter's official iPad app. It's going to be doing a lot more support for images and video. Tim, is this something that they had to do?
You know, it seems like everything must change. I mean, even Google changes occasionally. I mean, you got to keep up with the Joneses, especially when everybody is copying what you have or taking what you have and making their own interface out of it, whether it's TweetDeck or Seismic or, you know, any of these other Twitter applications that provide a different way to experience Twitter. That's competition when you're losing people to those devices, especially when, you know, you're trying to figure out a business model for your site.
Brett, is there a chance that this would this could make Twitter too complicated? I mean, one of the things that makes it work is that is the elegant nature of the process, that there's not much to know, there's not much to learn, you just kind of do it and you're kind of limited. Is there a danger there that as they add this that people might stop or might actually use it less?
No, I think if anything, what was happening is the users were making it more complicated by adding hashtags and links and at signs and all these other things, and this is just kind of a streamlining of can it work better in the use cases that the users have found over the last couple of years. Because I think the iPad app works fantastic, and if the new web app is similar to that in any way, I think it's just a win.
Yeah, and Lon, do you are you looking forward to the new upgrade?
Yes, and I think probably several million Twitter users today would have liked to have had it when that. Did you hear about the bug today that got exploited with the mouse hover
right
bug?
Yeah.
So this morning on Twitter, just about including
we're recording on Tuesday morning, by the way, for those.
Yes, Tuesday morning, the day of reckoning for any Twitter user using the web interface and hasn't been upgraded, which they quickly fixed to their credit. They got it certainly under control, but it was definitely scary this morning logging in and seeing even the White House press secretary getting hacked by this very exploitable bug, apparently. So at least they got that on track. But overall, I one of the things that really impresses me about Twitter is just how the users have so much defined how this operates. And in many ways, the redesign that I've seen, at least from the screenshots, kind of reflects how the users have started using Twitter and how they made it work for them. And the company's kind of followed you know, the path of the users in that regard, which is kind of a neat way to build a business.
Jumping into the next story, Apple TV. Now this is something I think a lot of us already thought. This is from Ars Technica, and what they're saying is the next generation Apple TV, of course, is widely rumored to have the same OS. It's just running iOS on it. And of course, that means that possibly it is a jailbreak target. You know, and of course, the reason the jailbreaking, I think, is more important in this case, it's as important as it was when the iPhone was originally jailbroken, which is that people want more apps. I think that, you know, Apple went halfway. They didn't quite go all the way down the path of really giving us what we really want on our TV, which is just an iPhone interface and all the access to all the apps that we want to use. And so it could theoretically be jailbroken and allow us to do this. Tim, do you think this is a big deal? Do you think Apple's going this direction anyway?
Well, I mean, we'll find out in 2 to 3 weeks. That's what the website says.
Right.
I bought my Apple TV as soon as they announced the new one. I figured for $99 and I get another Netflix device, that's a deal.
Right.
And, you know, just based on that. But, you know, my day job working at MDialog, this is huge for us. I mean, we're keeping our fingers crossed because it's not out yet. You never know until you actually play with it. But it looks like we'll be able to deliver pre-rolls, multiple mid-rolls, and interactive overlays on video streaming content through this device. Right. I mean, we'll know for sure when it's out. But that's exciting also from a creative standpoint in that you now can do things that you could only do on the iPad. Are we going to be able to interact with the iPad and the Apple TV? I'm hoping so. This should be fun. So it's exciting times.
Yeah, absolutely. Lon, do you think you'd be tempted to jailbreak it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would buy it to do that.
Right. I'm looking at it. When I saw this, I was like, I think I'm going to buy one just to jailbreak it.
Right. Yeah. And the problem is, though, for mass consumers and mass consumers of our content, you know, most people aren't like us.
Right.
So the hope would be that Apple would and clearly they seem to be on that track. If they're running iOS on this thing, it can have an easy path to creating apps that run on the device, unlike the old Apple TV, which was really locked down. It didn't have a path for that to happen. So I'm excited about it. I'm looking forward to the iFixit teardown, because they always do a great job of identifying what's there. And I'm most interested to see actual storage is on the device. I wouldn't be surprised if there's like a 4 gig flash memory on there to store applications and operating system overhead, because iOS is easily a 500 meg.
I think the rumor is 8 gigs.
System. 8 gigs. So that's all you need, especially if you're streaming everything.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Brett, do you think Apple's going to go down the path of opening this up to apps?
Yeah, that's kind of my personal belief. I have a sneaking suspicion that they're going to be handling this a lot like they handled the iPhone. The iPhone wasn't all about the apps when it first came out. And now we have this Apple TV that's an entirely new input. You can't just throw all of the iPhone apps on it like we did with the iPad. So I have a feeling they're just coming in under the radar, and they'll let some developers do some magic in the intervening time before they say, hey, look at all the amazing things this Apple TV also does now.
Right, right. Absolutely. So I think a lot of us will figure this out as it comes out here. Now, this is the last story for today. Probably, you know, it's a great one to end with. Probably could have been the lead story. This is, of course, the anti-piracy leak. That is the code used in the set-top boxes for Blu-ray and DVDs has been cracked. I know that we're all surprised, shocked, that this would actually happen, that someone would actually crack an encryption that was uncrackable. But this has been published to the internet, and as a result, we're probably going to see devices on the market that allow people to make unauthorized copies of movies. And Intel confirmed this was. So what happened was, it came out. This is according to CNET. Of course, it came out, and of course, the movie industry said, "Well, we would never agree to anything that had a back door." And then Intel said, "Well, yeah, it might have had a master key." So it's like, do we tell the boss that? Yeah, we put in a master key. So this was supposed to be uncrackable. It was supposed to be something that was going to protect Blu-ray, and a lot of people were holding out. And arguably, you know, there's some things that have been held out. You know, there are some big movie companies that had held out some of their most valuable assets to make sure that it wasn't cracked. And now we may never see those assets because the master key. And the problem is, I think, for people listening, is the issue is that you end up with a situation where you can't go back and rebuild all those. You know, you can't change this part of the pipeline. So, Tim, is this as big a deal as it sounds?
Well, you can pick your friends and you can pick your nose, but you can't pick your friend's nose.
I don't know how you tie that into a cogent conversation is going to be fascinating.
You know, I mean, the whole picking of the lock here type thing.
Right.
What I want to know is, wasn't somebody supposed to get paid a lot of money if they cracked it, or was that a different? Am I getting that confused with a different code?
I think that was HD DVD. I think that was the computer.
That was the competitor one.
Oops.
Oh, okay.
Oops. Yeah, I don't think that there was any promise for that for Blu-ray.
Darn it. I wanted somebody to get the big paycheck.
Yeah. But even with the big paycheck, I mean, the big lack of paycheck is that, you know, of course, that this is going to be a, you know, it does, you know, they can still try to put extra data in the code. So, for instance, they can try to watermark it. They can, and it's still, I think you have to capture it in real time. So this isn't something you can just kind of rip it faster than real time. You're capturing the data as it comes out of the, out of the port. So it's, you know, so it's, so you're still just hitting record essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, there always seems whenever you set up a hurdle, somebody's going to jump over it. I mean, you know, what we're doing in adaptive bitrate streaming right now, where you break everything into little chunks and then you encrypt those little chunks and you also put other protections in the firewall. It just makes it inconvenient to go through all these steps over and over and over. But if you can find a place to plug in and just hit record, then yeah, have a nice day.
Well, and the problem is that only one person has to be able to do it. You know, so yeah, it may be inconvenient, but there are people who have proven that they're willing to deal with the inconvenience of pirating, because once one person is able to get a good copy, and it's not going to be one, it's going to be 100 or 1,000 people. Now BitTorrent is going to get nice, solid copies. Lon, do you think this is a do you think this is going to stop people from producing Blu-rays?
I don't think so. I think what the biggest impediment to copying a Blu-ray specifically is the fact that it's like 25 or 50 gigabytes, and
right.
That's just the blanks cost, and the recorder. I mean, by the time you make that investment, you're better off just buying a library of Blu-rays and be done with it. But this is just. We all knew that all these copy protection schemes were inevitably going to be broken. Blu-ray has largely been cracked for quite some time. HDCP, which many were hoping would be the barrier to keep the set-top boxes locked down, was something that might stick around. I think personally that what's happened over time is that people start pirating when it gets harder to get stuff the way they want it. So if anything, perhaps this will open up the floodgates like we've seen with music. It's much easier to go spend $5 or $10, $15 maybe on an album than it is to go try to hunt it down on a BitTorrent site and get virused or whatever else could happen to you. And I think the movie industry needs to follow the same path. The DVD movies are already completely broken to the point where, as far as the copy protection goes, that they are just as vulnerable as a CD to piracy. So what's the big deal? Let's just open this stuff up. I'll gladly pay my money, and I want to watch it on my Apple TV, my Roku, and my TiVo at the same time, and just let me do it.
Well, it does seem does seem like the big issue is the only way to fight this is to make it easy. I mean, the only reason Apple has made billions on music that was easy to pirate. And the reason that they did that was because they made it easy. They made it simple. They made it largely invisible to the average user. Now, of course, a bunch of us get frustrated that we can only put it on 5 computers, and we get frustrated that we couldn't play those DRM stuff in the old days anywhere else. But, my parents never noticed. My kids didn't notice. I mean, they were just kind of like, they just would just download it, and it worked on their iPod and on their computer. And they didn't think about it after that, and it was easy to transfer, and it was easy to use. And the problem is every time you look at this, I mean, it's even stuff like Stu Mashwitz was posting on Twitter this morning that he was – just frustrated. He said, if I ever have any power in Hollywood, I'm going to, get rid of all these opening previews and ads before the Blu-ray, that you're forced to watch on Blu-ray. There's no way to get around
it. Those are horrible.
And the thing is every time I think about that, I just go, well, you could pirate it. I'm not saying that Stu or I should do that, but I'm just saying that's what, people just go, well, if this is too inconvenient for me, I'm just not going to bother. And that's I think that's the real challenge, for the industry is that, we just if it gets too hard, if it's harder to buy it and own it than it is to pirate it, that's not going to be a battle that they can win. I mean, Brett, is there any other way for them to handle that?
Maybe I'm completely wrong the psychology of piracy, but it doesn't feel like there's anything to win. I'm kind of the opinion that they're losing money on all this piracy right now and their files later, and the exact same net loss.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that the issue here is, and the other thing is for many people who are listening and going, oh my gosh, this just happened. The one thing to realize that a lot of, there's a lot of equipment out there, in the professional realm. By professional realm, I mean $200 cards that ignore the HDCP thing, because in a professional environment, oftentimes you just don't want to deal with any of that. And usually that's kind of classed in its own. And this was the case back in the day, whether it was DVDs or whether it was VHS or whether it was, there was lots of things that were built in to protect stuff. And as soon as you paid a certain amount and bought a professional, device, it just was like, yeah, we're not going to worry about that. We're all professionals here. So the thing is the ability to rip this stuff, in real time from a recorder, it has been something that's been available since Blu-ray came out. It's the ability to do it, on more of a consumer level that has changed. So I don't know how much this has really changed their environment at all, other than making, more people in Hollywood, shake. But I think that, I still feel like we're not there yet. But I feel like I just want to pay $50 a month and just be able to download whatever movies I want to watch. Or $100 a month. I'll just pay $100 a month and then just give me an open access to it. And then you guys all get a couple pennies. And while you're only getting a couple pennies out of this whole thing per every time I watch a movie, or you get $2 or $3 or whatever, it's going to be a lot more than, what's happening now. That's the whole thing I feel like we are moving to a future where, content itself is commoditized. There's community around it. There's sales around it. But it is not the thing that you sell for much longer. It's the thing that you attract people with that you then sell them stuff. You know, but I don't, you know, I think that content itself is going to be harder and harder to sell, you know, over the next 10 or 20 years, because it's just, it's going to be so ubiquitous. I think that one of the problems that we got into when we, you know, was in the mass piracy of music, wasn't just that we were pirating music. It's that suddenly everybody has access. I had lots of CDs, but it was harder to access them. And so I had to think about it. And so radio was still interesting at times. Once I had all of my entire CD collection and my wife's entire CD collection on one classic iPod, you know, it's 150 gigs of music, and I can get to any, you know, music that I wanted to, my interest in new music, I have to admit, dropped dramatically. Mm-hmm. You know, and as my movie collection got bigger, my interest in new movies, you know, changes. And of course, being a parent, it changes dramatically too, just because you can't get there. But the point is that I think that when we suddenly have these huge libraries that we have instant access to, that we can, gather, and the average person might have 500 or 1,000 movies, the interest in new content, I think, changes. And I think that's going to be a bigger challenge than piracy as we, you know, go into the future.
That's interesting. I think I've probably fallen into the same patterns with like television, because there's, like you said, there's just so much video content available through the web and through television and everything. If I'm bored at all, I just jump on Hulu or Netflix and stream something. Like, it doesn't even really matter to me. And as a result, right, I don't bother with, I don't see the new Mad Men or True Blood, any of the hot new shows that are on any premium channels. I'm just like, I'll see those when they come out on disc on Netflix.
Well, you know, what's funny is I same way with Mad Men. My brother is a huge fan of Mad Men, and he's just like, oh, you got to watch it. And I'm like, well, it's not on Netflix, and so it doesn't really exist for me yet.
I will. I'll watch it. Give it a year or two.
Yeah, yeah. Right. When it comes out on Netflix, I'll get it.
In fact, I'm like really deep in Veronica Mars right now and pretty excited about it.
Right. Right, absolutely. Yeah, so it's interesting. To me, there's so much content that's out there. I don't really need that one yet. When it comes out, it'll be available. You know, and I have to admit, my home viewing system is good enough that when I don't see movies on a first run in the theater, unless it's something really, really like Avatar or something like that, I'm like, I'll see it at home. It'll be fine. You know, like, I'm not too worried about that. And usually when I say I'm going to see it at home, it's becoming, I'll wait until it shows up on Netflix and then I'll watch it. You know?
Yeah.
So anyway, it's very interesting. Brett, where can people find you?
Well, there's a lot going on. So just hunt me down on Twitter at Amtrekker, AmTrekker.
Tim, where can people find you?
I'll be at my mailbox waiting for my Mad Men DVD to arrive from Netflix. Because I'm hooked on it now, man. You can find me at onetimstreet.com or mdialogue.com.
Fantastic. And Lon, where can people find you?
Find me at LONSEIDMAN on Twitter, and I'll be also going to the space shuttle launch as a NASA tweet-up participant later on in early November. So I will be sending some pretty cool stuff from that when I'm there.
Nice. Thank you. This mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out. This Week in Media is a Pixelcore.tv production produced by Suzanne Llewellyn, with technical producers John Riley and Alutha Jamankar. Content contributor is Jason Perrier.